This is PCJ Radio International. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Hello and welcome to the monthly edition of the program. Today, Jeff White will join us to talk about the radio spectrum in Tunisia. Keith will join us for a look at the ongoing spat between the BBC and the London School of Economics. The LSE is crying foul over a trip to North Korea that the BBC tagged along on, this despite that the students were all informed that a journalist from the BBC's Panorama program would be with them. We're also going to talk interference. Not intentional interference, but the kind that is caused by computers, TV sets, and everyday electrical items around the home. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Media Network Plus, the show that dances across the airwaves. Panorama has been on the BBC since 1953, and since that time, the show has created a reputation for producing some award-winning documentaries. Along with this, Panorama has not shied away from criticism. Just before Euro 2012, the program was blasted for a documentary they did on racism in Ukraine. In 2006, they were blasted for a program that looked at sex crimes in the Vatican, mental and physical abuse in hospitals in the UK, and many other important topics. On Monday, April 15th, they aired a program called North Korea Undercover, with reporter John Sweeney, who joined a group of students from the London School of Economics on a tour to the secretive country. But 24 hours before the program was to air on BBC One, the LSE demanded the BBC shelve the program and started a very public attack against the methods the BBC used to gain access to North Korea. This is a story Keith has been following closely. He now joins us to put more perspective on what has transpired.
Tonight, inside the world's most secretive nation, North Korea's Supreme Commander Kim Jong-un is threatening thermonuclear war against the United States. With tensions escalating, Panorama spends 8 days undercover inside the most rigidly controlled nation on Earth. So, welcome to the real North Korea. A landscape bleak beyond words.
Last Sunday, the day before BBC Panoramas was going to air a program that they did called North Korea Undercover, the London School of Economics came out accusing the BBC of not informing the students of their true plan to have a journalist sent on the trip. Now, let me explain this first. The London School of Economics is a well-known university in the United Kingdom. Some students who actually go to the LSE decided to organize a trip to North Korea. This trip had nothing to do with the London School of Economics. It's sort of like, you say, members of the student union who said, oh, we're going to go off to the DPRK. So the London School of Economics was not involved in this trip at all. The trip was organized by the wife of BBC journalist John Sweeney and the Korean Friendship Association. The Korean Friendship Association is, you can say, directly linked to the North Korean government. They're sort of like their tourism organization. So this trip was organized, and the students were told, look, a BBC journalist would be going with you. Do you have a problem with that? And they said no. In fact, they even sat down with the BBC and the journalist saying that, this is what they want to do when they go to North Korea. So the students were informed right from the beginning that a BBC journalist would be going along with them. The LSE comes out and says, oh, they were never informed of the true nature. The BBC was using these students as human shields, which is totally, totally incorrect, because the students were informed that because there's a journalist going with you, there are risks involved. We're talking about a country here, North Korea, that does not allow foreign journalists in. Even people that go in as tourists have to have a minder with them. So it was a way for the BBC to actually get in, especially right now because North Korea is a hot topic in the news. They were told in London, they spoke to all the students twice before going to North Korea when they were at Beijing, in the Beijing airport. John Sweeney and his camera and John Sweeney's wife were there. And they got on the plane, they went to North Korea, they came back after 8 days, did the documentary, and then all of a sudden, the day before this program was going to air, the LSE saying it was unethical, etc., etc., etc. Now, one thing, Paulette, I need to point out. While it's true, yes, John Sweeney did lie about his credentials. He lied about his credentials to the North Koreans, because if he put down BBC journalist, he never would have gotten in.
Not likely.
Exactly. That is a pure fact. And what he did is not new. This is something, I mean, going back to the 1950s, a number, not too often, but there were some journalists from Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, that went into the Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries and went with organizations that they knew just to be able to get in, to get a story, and then head out. Now, in 2007, I was asked to accompany one journalist in particular, to Burma. Now, Burma is another area where journalists are just not welcome, especially at the time. Things in Burma have changed now. So we decided to piggyback on a cultural organization that was going in to get the story. And we told them, you know, we want to join the group, and we told them exactly the reasons why. So this is not new. It's not, of course, the ideal practice. You don't have to do this if you're going into, let's say, Mexico or Argentina, but we're talking about North Korea here, and this is really the only way to get in. Now, it would have been unethical, let's say, if the BBC had not informed the students what they were planning to do, but they did. But for some reason, the LSE came out saying something totally different. This is what Sir Peter Sutherland, who is the chair of governors at the LSE, had to say.
They most certainly didn't have enough information to make an informed decision. They were not told the full nature of what was happening, that this was, in effect, an hour-long investigative journalist filming, which was going to take place. So they were going into North Korea without full knowledge, and therefore potentially finding themselves in a situation of great danger and risk in an unpredictable environment, an unpredictable state, and one that is considered by many to be a dangerous state. The reality is that full and informed consent was never given by the students to the trip that actually took place. They did not know that they were part of a covert action to run a serious, long, hour-long program, I understand, on BBC with covert filming of what was happening. Well, you would think if the BBC was doing a risk assessment that the students themselves, and indeed their parents, some of whom now object to the whole program, might also have been given the opportunity to assess the risk. They were not, because they were not given, on the admission of the BBC, full information as to what was about to happen. The identity of the students would have been readily obtainable and would have been known in due course. The application to go to North Korea, to the North Koreans, was in the name of LSE. It would undoubtedly have come to light that LSE was involved, and it's utterly naive and disingenuous to suggest that LSE are responsible, or the students themselves for that matter, for the fact that this is now in the public domain.
Well, Paulette, that was Sir Peter Sutherland, chair of governors at the LSE. So they came out with this on Sunday, and all of a sudden, the BBC was in a position of, wait a second, you're asking us to cancel this program, and you're saying things that are totally foreign to us because we had informed the students and we told them what we were going to do. And this is Siri Thomas, the head of BBC News, and his response to the London School of Economics.
Key thing for us was, could we give these students, remember these are mostly in their 20s to late 20s, could we give them enough information to give their informed consent to a decision about whether they were prepared to go on a trip to North Korea accompanied by a journalist? The thing that the North Koreans look out for is journalists. They don't distinguish particularly between a Panorama journalist or an ITV journalist. The students needed to know the risks they were running if they were caught with a journalist, and we told them what those risks were. We told them that they could be arrested, they could be detained, they could be deported. We made that very clear to them twice in London before they left here and once in Beijing on the way into North Korea. This was a trip that took place last year, organised by the same person who organised it this year, who happens, yes, to be married to a BBC journalist. It would have happened without the BBC being involved. It would have happened if the BBC had pulled out. This was a trip that was going to happen anyway that the BBC piggybacked on. It was up to these students as adults to assess the risk themselves and up to us as an organisation to make sure that they had the information to do that, and I'm totally satisfied that we did. They knew that they were being accompanied by a journalist, and that was the material fact that they needed to know in order to make up their minds whether this was a risk they were prepared to take. As they got closer to North Korea, we told them exactly what the makeup of the BBC crew was, but the key thing was from the very beginning, before they'd handed over any money, before they'd signed up to this trip, they had been told the nature of the fact that there was a journalist going along with them. There's absolutely no evidence that we were risking the lives of these students. Had we had any kind of assessment that said we were putting their lives at risk, we would have done something very different. We would have pulled out of the trip, I'm sure. Our assessment was that the most likely outcome, were it discovered that there was a journalist on the trip, was that these students might be deported. The risk, I think, lay primarily with the BBC crew, and we wanted to keep it that way. We wanted to make sure that the students knew enough to make up their minds about whether they wanted to take the risk, the added risk of having a journalist on board with them, but that they weren't part of the deception of the North Korean government, which was our responsibility. The LSE wasn't involved in this trip. This society is separate from the LSE. It's autonomous and independent. So the LSE were not in the fray. We didn't deceive the LSE. We didn't involve them because they weren't actually involved in the pulling together of this trip. We made a very thorough risk assessment. We conveyed that to the students who are actually going on the trip, and I think that's the appropriate and right way for us to have done it. The thing we've got to hold on to here is there is an overwhelming public interest case in seeing at this moment what's going on inside North Korea. The temperature in that region is extraordinarily high. We hardly ever get a glimpse inside this country. And for us to see now what the atmosphere is like, what the mood is like on the streets, is a very, very powerful piece of public interest journalism. I'm very glad that we've done that. So yes, actually, I think we made the right decisions, we gave the right level of information, and I'm happy with where we are.
That was Siri Thomas, the head of programs for BBC News, with his response to the chair of governors for the London School of Economics, Sir Peter Sutherland. So it's sort of like at the beginning, it began as a, you know, he said, she said kind of scenario.
Well, that's exactly what it amounts to. Maybe that's by design. Maybe that's exactly what they want. But who would want that and why?
Well, you know, nobody knows. Some people have speculated maybe Panorama at some point in the past did a program about the London School of Economics that they just didn't like. Now, let's move forward.
They hold a grudge that long.
Well, I mean, it's politics. You know, that's the way things are. But let's move ahead to Wednesday. Now, 2 days after BBC Panorama broadcast this documentary, which I should mention, rather, I've seen, and there's really nothing new in it, but it's the fact that they got in, and they're still showing North Korea for what it is, and it's a good way to remind people of the odd nature of this place. There were 10 students that went on this trip. There were three that all of a sudden said that they weren't informed, but the rest of them, the six of them, are saying that they were informed. Now, six students sent an open letter to the London School of Economics because they said, because the LSE decided to complain publicly about this, that it put them in a more uncomfortable position than they originally were.
By uncomfortable, do you mean more dangerous?
More at risk.
Wow.
In the open letter to the LSE director, Craig Claghorn, and the chairman, Sir Peter Sutherland, the students said, "We feel we have now been put at more risk than was originally the case as a result of the LSE decision to go public with their story." They also went on to say, "When the story broke to the international media in response to a complaint about the TRIMP, none of us were consulted by the LSE or their representatives for our accounts. Some of us have still not been consulted. We therefore are compelled to establish the basic facts of the case, many of which have been distorted in the media in this joint statement." So, this is where it gets into a funny position, because the LSE, who I say again, had nothing to do with this trip, comes out defending these students. And, you know, we have to remind ourselves here. These are not kids. They're not, 15, 14 years old. They're all, between 20 and 30. They're adults. They made a conscious decision with the information that was given to them by the BBC. Now, of course,
and an informed decision.
Now, we have to remember, Paul, in this kind of situation where you're doing this kind of undercover work with a country like North Korea, sure, there are things that the BBC didn't tell them. And not telling them certain aspects of the intention for the reporters to go there is a wise thing. Because you have to think, the BBC is thinking, okay, we're not going to tell them this because if, for example, the game is up and we are caught, when they say they don't know anything, they really don't know anything. So they were given enough information to make a conscious decision whether or not to continue with the trip. Now, these six students have come in support of the documentary and have come in support of the BBC for what, for the way this was handled. But for some reason, the LSE has come out, said something completely in opposition to the BBC, completely in opposition to what the students agreed to. And, this is where it goes into now a real humorous area, because Panorama has, as you mentioned, has been on the air for years. Mm-hmm. Now, if the LSC had not said anything, this program would have gone to air, and that's it. The audience would have watched it, and next week there'd be another episode. But because the LSC came out Sunday and Monday going on about this, the audience share for Panorama jumped to 69%. They had 5.4 million viewers that night for that program. So put it this way, if I was a BBC producer, I would say, hey, thank you guys for the promotion.
Yeah, can you do it again?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Wow. Well, you know what, Keith? What I find just astounding is we've got two contradictory accounts here. The BBC is saying we informed the students, and many of the students are saying yes, they did. On the other side, you've got Sir Peter from the London School of Economics saying they weren't informed, and three students that say they were maybe a little uncomfortable or don't remember or whatever being informed. Now, there's no common ground here. There's no middle ground.
Well, I think there is. I mean, look, as soon as the students came out in support of the BBC, the London School of Economics has kept quiet. And, different media organizations have tried contacting them saying, well, wait a second, six students here came in support of the BBC saying they were informed about everything. Do you have a comment about what you said before? And do you have anything to say now because of what they said? And the London School of Economics is just saying, no.
No comment. Yeah,
it's sort of like they were caught in the situation because they didn't inform the students that they were going to go public with this. Now, the other thing that's kind of amusing, I mean, everybody's heard the rhetoric that comes out of North Korea, mm-hmm. especially over the past couple of weeks, saying they're going to bomb South Korea, etc., etc., etc. Now, some of the students said that they got some threats from Pyongyang diplomats in North Korea. Now, we have to understand here, everything that North Korea says is just that. It's just saying stuff. They're not going to bomb South Korea because they know that if they do, First of all, they're not going to win, and they know that's going to be the end of the regime. So all the stuff that they say is just it's their usual stuff that they've been saying since 1953.
The same rattling,
you know. And again, the threats only started coming after the London School of Economics went public with this.
So everybody wants to get in the limelight.
Yeah, you know, the North Koreans do because they love the publicity for themselves, you know. But again, you know, it's just kind of odd here because the London School of Economics was not involved in organizing this trip. They did not pay for it. The students themselves paid for the trip out of their own pockets, £2,000 each to go.
Well, Keith, you know what's really odd is, for one thing, you say that London School of Economics was not involved. So why did they take it upon themselves to speak on behalf of students who are, as you pointed out, adults, and without letting them know, without consulting them and asking them for their version of events? It's assuming, taking it upon themselves, saying, oh, they weren't informed, without checking their facts. This is like a prestigious school of business. That is something you do. That's the basics that you do, especially when you're dealing with the media, is you've got to get your facts straight first. What kind of a message is that sending to the competence of this or of this institution?
Well, you know,
for one thing,
some people are saying it's probably down just to arrogance.
But
the thing is, you want to know something, Paulette? Look, if I was one of these students, I would feel insulted that they're talking about me like I'm a teenager and I can't make up my own mind that I'm 25 years old. Going to North Korea, it is a very strange place. It's sort of like Disneyland high on drugs, you know? and it's not like, for example, if I said to you, Paulette, look, you and I, we're going to go to Vietnam and we're going to do this story, right? We can get a lot of the basic information before we actually head there, or even most of it. With North Korea, you don't know until you actually get there, you know, and it's one of those situations. You'll get there, maybe there's a story, a big story, and maybe you'll get there and there won't be anything at all. But you physically have to be on the ground. But getting back to the LSC here, you know, I'm interested to see what's going to happen over the next few days, because three students have complained about this. Why they're complaining, we haven't heard anything yet. You know, are they complaining because people are talking that, you know, they want to, you know, bring a lawsuit against the BBC? You know, is it just to say, you know, get money, or is it because they were pressured by the LSC to do this? We just sort of have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in hearing that. What transpires as well, and I'm sure our listeners will be interested as well. So thanks very much for this report, Keith, and I look forward to the next episode.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399, and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
One of the most exciting regions for radio and television is the Middle East. Ever since the Jasmine Revolution, stations of all kinds have been popping up like mushrooms. Jeff White was in Tunisia in February for the HFCC conference. He now brings us a look and listen to what he heard there.
The television offerings in our room at the hotel were a bit limited. The only English language channel was CNN International, which allowed us to keep up with world news. There was one channel in French, and the other five channels were in Arabic. Most of them seemed to be local, but one of them was Al Jazeera, in Arabic, from Qatar. As for radio reception, the AM band seemed to be dead, but I noted at least 26 FM stations, most of them in Arabic, but some in French. Besides Arabic music and Quran prayers, there was a fair amount of French and English language music, and I was surprised to hear a certain amount of Spanish language music from Latin America as well. The most interesting local station for foreigners is RTCI, Radio Tunis's international channel, which airs programming in Arabic and French, as well as various news bulletins and some longer programs each day in English, Spanish, and German.
And I thank you for listening to the English language program on FTC. Until we meet again, the headlines in French with Sarah Rache are next, and the German language program as well. Stay tuned, and goodbye from Tunis. Bye.
Tunis International Radio, English program.
Despite its name, RTCI is not really an external service. It's on a network of FM channels throughout the country, including 98.2 MHz in Tunis. It can be listened to abroad via internet. The Tunisian National Radio does have a shortwave service, but it transmits only in Arabic, beamed to Europe, the Middle East, and the Maghreb area of North Africa. They use a 500-kilowatt transmitter located in the city of Sfax in east-central Tunisia. I spoke to the engineers from ONT, the National Telecommunications Office of Tunisia, who were at the HFCC conference. They explained to me that ONT provides the transmission facilities for all radio stations in Tunisia, both government and privately owned. Right next door in Libya, just east of Tunisia, the national radio station ended its shortwave broadcasts 2 years ago during the civil war there, the engineers told me. But they're back on the air now, with Arabic programming only, although they told us that they will add English and French language programs in the future, beamed to Africa. They say they have two 500-kilowatt transmitters and a rotatable antenna. Reports indicate that the service is currently sporadic. On the west side of Libya is Algeria. Like Tunisia, the government-owned radio station operates a so-called international channel, Radio Algeria International, which is not on shortwave, but is on FM in Algiers. It can be heard internationally on the internet.
Radio Algeria International brings you up to date with the latest news around the globe. Politics, economy, weather, and other factual outputs are streaming out every day on both FM and satellite frequencies. For any queries or suggestions, send us your mail to www.algerian-radio.dz.
The Algerian radio does have a service on shortwave using the facilities of TDF, Télédiffusion de France, in Issoudun. But this appears to be temporary, as engineer Lotfi Khalali of Algeria's TDA explained to us that they are building two shortwave transmitter sites in Ourgla and Bekaa, each with a 300-kilowatt DRM-capable transmitter. These sites are expected to be on the air within the next year. The programming is intended for the countries of the Sahel in northwestern Africa, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Mauritania, Chad, and the Polisario Front areas. Over in northeastern Africa is the Sudan Broadcasting Corporation. A representative of the SBC at the HFCC conference told me they have shortwave broadcasts daily from 0300 to 2200 UTC on 7200 kHz in Arabic, beamed 205 degrees from Omdurman. And on 9505 kHz, they have English language programs in the mornings from 0400 to 1000 UTC at 110 degrees azimuth, and in the evenings from 16 to 2000 UTC at 210 degrees azimuth. They plan to add new equipment in the near future and expand to up to six frequencies, they told us. Unfortunately, I was not able to hear any of these transmissions when I tried at our location in suburban Tunis. But from my hotel balcony, I was able to hear another Middle Eastern station on shortwave with a very good signal. One of the strongest signals on shortwave at 2:35 p.m. here in Tunis, which would be 1335 UTC, on 17705 kilohertz, is Riyadh from Saudi Arabia with 500 kilowatts. After the close of the HFCC conference on February 1st, about half of the delegates took part in a sightseeing tour offered by the ASBU. The first stops were at some of the sites of the ancient Roman ruins of Carthage in the Tunis suburbs. Back at the hotel that evening, I switched on my radio on the balcony overlooking the Mediterranean. I was amazed to find programming from China Radio International in various languages all over the shortwave dial. I thought maybe my shortwave receiver had spur problems with so many frequencies occupied by China throughout the evening. But Vyacheslav Gergiev of Spaceline confirmed to me that this is normal in North Africa and Europe, at a time when many Western shortwave stations are reducing or eliminating their shortwave services. China Radio International is increasing them and seems to be the easiest station to hear on the bands. No wonder then that the Chinese delegation was the largest at the HFCC conference in Tunis. For them, shortwave is alive and well.
Interference. Did you know that in your home, everything from energy-saving light bulbs to toasters, TVs, and DVD players cause interference? For the past 20 years, more and more of us have acquired all kinds of electrical devices in our homes that are bringing more and more noise to the medium-wave part of the dial. But why is this interference happening? Should manufacturers not test equipment before bringing it to market? This is the question Keith asked Ian Baxter, a longtime radio fanatic in Australia.
The manufacturers are supposed to adhere to guidelines. They're set up, in the case of Australia and New Zealand, by certain electromagnetic compatibility standards. And I think the problem we have here is that while the device may have been tested, it's not actually being enforced, or doesn't seem to be being enforced in very many occasions. And that, of course, gives rise to a lot of interference issues. And it's not until customers might complain about something that really provides a lot of interference to, say, domestic local radio, that something might get done. And it's often left in the case of the customer to sort out the issues with their neighbours, for example.
In Australia, what is the situation? I have a friend of mine in Montreal, and when he contacted Industry Canada about some interference issues that he was having, they more or less ignored him. And they said, oh, well, there's nothing we can do. You should contact the manufacturer.
Mm.
Sort of passing the buck.
I'm sure a lot of that is going on. I can't actually say what the situation is. It may vary. I think if you do lodge a complaint with, in Australia, it's the Australian Communications Authority. I think you normally pay something like a $50 or $60 fee. If you can't actually resolve it, mm-hmm. or can't find out where the interference is, they'll come out after you've completed the paperwork and perhaps track down where the interference is. But I mean, if it's a piece of a neighbour's equipment, then it's normally left between you and the neighbour to perhaps sort it out amicably, if that's at all possible. Regarding the equipment itself, if it's a widespread problem, it may be a case of going back to the manufacturer. I think it's probably a case of seeing how bad the problem is. The problem, I think, with a lot of the manufacturing, however, is that the government organisations and the people who make up the standards seem to be more in favour of supporting the manufacturers, or more concerned about their costs, such that the market's essentially flooded with products that the first priority is cost rather than looking at interference issues. Generally, the more you pay for a product, perhaps the better quality it might be, perhaps the less interference you might result from that.
There was a guy that I was talking to in London, and in Europe, it's a lot of people still listen to long wave. And he told me for almost 2 years now, at night he couldn't listen to long wave. He just couldn't listen to long wave, and then all of a sudden he figured out why. A family that lives next door to him, they went away for a week, and at night there was no problem listening to long wave. And what he did is he set up his radio and he turned it on at 6 o'clock and just left the recorder running, and when they turned on their television, everything on long wave just went blank.
Mm.
So he contacted them next door and he said, do you have a grounding problem or something? And he said, I can't listen to anything on long wave. And they said, well, why would you want to listen to the BBC?
This sounds similar to the problem I had when I actually brought up the issue when Australia was... and New Zealand were looking at devising some electromagnetic compatibility and interference standards. I was essentially concerned about what effect that it would have on shortwave. To me, it was looking at the early draft standards that there'd be no protection or very little protection for shortwave at all. So I rang the gentleman in the Australian Communications Authority, and I was essentially told that, shortwave's a dying medium. It'll broadcast will soon be transmitted on the internet. So, I was more than a little disappointed by that response. I was basically told, tough. and essentially, after all this time, it's come to play out that we're left with a situation where my worst fears have come to play, whereby you've got worsening interference now, and I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why several people have left shortwave, and perhaps as a result of the loss of listeners, we've got less broadcasters out there transmitting to the various parts of the world.
Well, with shortwave listeners, Ian, I mean, it's interesting that you bring up that subject, because recently, just a couple of days ago, the BBC World Service reduced many of their transmissions. And they already said that they're going to lose many listeners. And I remember a number of years ago when they started reducing transmissions to Southeast Asia, they cut back on frequencies, they cut back on hours. And then they said, oh, we have to reduce more because nobody is listening. And I was thinking, well, the reason why nobody's listening because they can't find you anymore.
Well, I think even in my situation, the interference is, you can do your best to try and reduce a lot of interference, but particularly when you're living in built-up areas of cities and more people are moving into units, it becomes just too difficult. You either give up your hobby or you essentially perhaps DX or shortwave listen in a quieter area. Sure, there's a few things that you can do to help minimise or combat the interference, but I guess to many people it all becomes far too hard, particularly when perhaps the internet's an option.
Now, what about medium wave in Australia? Because for, you know, many countries, for example, in the US, medium wave is still very popular. And a lot of the modern electronic items that we have interfere with local medium wave stations, just as they do here in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
If you mention this, let's say, to government officials, do they just say the same thing? Oh, medium wave is also out. You can listen on the internet now, or what?
There's still a lot of people listening to medium wave in this country. And generally, I guess it depends on each person's situation. If you've got a strong enough signal, it might be fine. But I do notice when I'm driving about that, well, there'll be areas where you get problems with interference, one being traffic lights is a major one, underneath power lines. At the moment, medium wave's still popular here, but I guess since they've introduced DAB Plus here, they might be perhaps be encouraging people to take that and use that avenue to listen to their local broadcast stations.
In the US right now, and in some other countries, they've been experimenting by sending the internet through power lines.
I think that source of interference has been right up there when you look at sources of interference. I've had somebody here transmit that, and it just almost completely wipes out all but the very strongest of shortwave stations here. And I could well imagine that it had the same effect on the weaker medium wave stations as well. I've seen a lot of complaints in US, or particularly the UK, regarding that. And I know they're selling the several retailers are selling that equipment here. Fortunately, that's not a lot of people using that, but that's one of those sources of interference that, again, if one was to make a complaint to government authorities, perhaps they might suggest you work it out between you and your neighbour.
Now, we just heard from Ian that despite laws and regulations, the problem is they are often not enforced. Stations between 580 to 1730 kilohertz are very often affected. In some countries, stations are leaving the AM dial and switching to FM to avoid this problem. There are ways to improve reception on AM. One is by using a good active antenna. We sent one to Michael Stevenson in Port Macquarie, Australia, for a review. It was a Texan AM200. We asked him how it performed with stations in Australia and stations in the Asia Pacific. He starts his review by telling us about AM DXing from his location.
I haven't had a lot of success here in Port Macquarie. I don't know why. I can pick up New Zealand stations, but you see, we have so many stations in Australia, and there's not many clear spots on the dial, and they're also very strong. Most of them use 5 kilowatts, and even some of the ABC stations use up to 50 kilowatts. So it makes it very difficult for DXing from foreign countries here.
All right. Now, we sent you a package. It got there wet, but nevertheless, everything was fine.
Yep.
We sent you a Texan AN200 antenna, which is an antenna that I have used myself, but I wanted to get somebody else's feedback. So Michael gladly agreed to assist us and let us know what you thought of it, what you think of it. First of all, how would you describe, if somebody said to you, what does it look like? What does the AN200 antenna look like?
Well, it really looks like a piece of sculpture. It's a very strongly built, made out of very hard plastic. The loop itself is made out of clear plastic, and the enamel copper wire is wound very tightly and neatly around that. And it measures about 9 inches in diameter. And then on the bottom with the base, it's got this curved black plastic shape that really looks nice. And on one end, it's got a large tuning knob, and on the other end, it's got a little socket where you can plug it directly into a antenna socket on a receiver.
It's funny you should say that, because the one that I have at home is in my living room. And I had some people over one day, and one of my friends looked at it, and he went, "Oh, this is an interesting piece. Where did you buy it?" And I told him, "It's an antenna." And he looked at me, and he went, "You mean it's one of those monstrosities that you have on your roof?" And I said, "Yes." So it actually is. It is a nice looking piece.
Yep, it sure is.
Now it does look nice. What is the performance like?
Well, it depends on the radio that you're using with it. I've got an Eaton E1 receiver, which I don't know whether you know much about those ones, but it doesn't have a built-in loop antenna for medium wave. So the only way you can get AM reception on it is to plug an antenna into it. And it's even got a strange antenna socket on, unlike most portable shortwave radios. It's a PAL socket. And it's probably got an impedance of between 50 and 75 ohms. So rather than cut the supplied cable that came with the Texan AN200, I made up another cable with a suitable plug. And there's three wires in that plug. So I plugged it into the Eaton and fiddled with the configuration, and all configurations produced the same results, and it was absolutely lousy. But on saying that, the antenna did actually work to a degree where the tuning knob peaks the single, and you can also null out interference very effectively if there's two stations on the one frequency. But then I decided to try my trusty old medium wave only radio that was made by Philips in Australia in 1966, so it's pretty ancient. But I set the antenna beside that radio, and this is what they call inductance coupling. And I was absolutely blown away by the increasing performance on that old radio.
So that means what you're saying then is, if you have, let's say, an Eaton, their Eaton radio that you were talking about, or some other type of communications receiver, you should check actually the antenna connection on it, or just modify one and build one yourself. And you said that if I was to say to ask you, like, on a scale from 1 to 10, how much did it improve the AM reception on the Eaton?
Well, it didn't actually improve it at all. I use an outdoor antenna. It's a wire antenna made by Power Electronics in America. It's a EFSWL. It's a 15-meter or 45-foot long wire with an impedance-matching transformer. So it comes into the house with a 50-ohm coax cable. And most medium-wave stations here at night produce plus 20 dB over S9 on the single-strength meter. With the Texan plugged into the Eaton, it actually reduced that to S7.
I see. But why do you think it had a different performance with the Philips radio?
Well, I think because the Eaton only has a 50 to 75 ohm impedance input, I think there was a gross mismatch in impedance, and it actually made the Texan perform really lousy. But on the old Philips, I can't tune the Texan antenna inductively through the Eaton because it doesn't have a loop stick antenna built into it.
It's interesting that you say that, because when I tried the antenna myself, I first tried it on a Sanjen ATS-909X.
Yep.
And to be perfectly honest, I really didn't notice very much, because the antenna for medium wave on the ATS-909X, internally, the internal AM antenna, performs extremely well anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
But when I tried the antenna on an older receiver that I had, an old Panasonic, and connected it up to that, it made a huge difference.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting, because the result that you had using, say, a more modern receiver and a much older receiver is exactly the same.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe the older receiver is not adequate enough with its built-in loop antenna, and when I put the Texan beside it, it was almost like switching on a preamp. It just boosted the signal so much on the old radio, it was not funny.
And what about noise?
Well, I suffer a lot of local noise here due to plasma TVs and all sorts of things because I live in suburbia, Port Macquarie. And I do have a lot of troubles on the medium wave band and also the tropical shortwave bands. And the outdoor antennas, they just don't cut it. But the Texon, well, it didn't do much on the Eton, but on the old radio, it boosted the signal so much that it seemed to also lower the noise level.
You said, you know, in your area of Australia, there is a lot of noise. We did a show about interference last week, and it's amazing, actually, because the medium wave part of the band over the past few years has been getting a lot of noise. But what also is interesting is that in some countries, they've either decided to do away with medium wave, but countries like the United States, for example, they're expanding into it, which is very strange. What about Australia? Is Australia, how is Australia doing with medium wave? Are they leaving the dial, or are they, you know, staying put?
Well, a lot of stations, and particularly in the capital cities, have left medium wave and gone to FM, and also DAB digital radio now as well. And a lot of ethnic stations are now coming on to the band. You know, you've got Italians and Greeks and Lebanese stations and all that sort of thing, which are now taking up the frequencies.
So there's still life in AM.
Yeah, definitely. And here in Port Macquarie, our only local medium wave station, which is on 531 kilohertz, is still in parallel with the FM counterpart.
Right. All right, Michael, final question. On a scale from 1 to 10, how would you rate this radio? Well, because you and I have both had the same results. The first one is, how would you rate this antenna on a new radio and an old radio? And what would your suggestions be?
Well, on the new radio, which is the Eton E1, which is a strange radio compared to, say, a Texan PL660, which I don't have to try, I would rate it as a 2 out of 10. On the old medium wave radio that I've got here with inductive coupling, I would rate it a 9 out of 10.
That's not a little difference, that's a huge difference.
Oh, it's amazing. I couldn't get over the difference. I thought this antenna isn't really working all that well until I tried it on the old radio.
And how is it? How easy is it using the tuning dial on the antenna?
Well, it's very, very easy. It's not terribly fine tuning where you've got to sort of tune it so slowly that you miss the peak. The peak is actually quite wide, so it's very easy to tune it. And the actual numbers on the knob or on the casing actually match up with the frequency that you're tuned to. So if you're at the bottom end of the medium wave band, the knob is right down to near zero.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for your insights of the Texan AN200. You have yourself a good day now.
Yes, thank you very much, Keith. It's been a pleasure.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Now, a look at propagation for the week. Here's Dan Hensley.
Here's the propagation forecast from April 27th to May 3rd, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux starts out on April 27th and 28th at 110, up 5 points to 115 on April 29th and 30th. May 1st, up 5 more points to 120, up 5 more points to 125 on May 2nd and 3rd. The A index is stable all week long at 5 from April 27th to May 3rd, and the KP index also stable all week at 2. Sunspot AR1726 has developed a Delta-class magnetic field that harbors energy for strong eruptions. This has prompted NOAA forecasters to have a greater expectation of M-class flares to 40% and X-class flares to 15% within the period of time between April 23rd and 24th. Because of the sunspot's almost central location on the solar disk, any eruptions in that time would have been likely Earth-directed. AR-1726 is more than a dozen times wider than Earth, which makes it an easy target for backyard solar telescopes. Sunspot 1723 is passing out of view this week. 1726 and 27 are in view. With 1726 being so large and unstable, we should expect more activity such as continuing flares and noisy band conditions. A photo of 1726 shows us planet-sized dark cores with smaller granules surrounding it, and those granules mean lots of massive boiling on a titanic scale. Two coronal holes are sending a solar wind hurling towards Earth, and this means disruptions to the bands. All of this indicates bad news for propagation this week. On April 20th, we received a propagation report from Michael Stevenson in Eastern Australia. He said, from 0330 UTC on bands between 31 to 16 meters, many, many signals were heard, some extremely strong, just like the old days. Have not heard such wonderful shortwave reception for at least 12 months or longer. Could not log and report all that was heard. You can see Mr. Stevens' frequency log at the PCJ Media Facebook page.
Thanks, Dan. And with that, we've come to the end of this month's edition of the program. Feel free to email us anytime at mnp@pcjmedia.com. That email address again is mnp@pcjmedia.com. And remember, you can listen to this program again or download past editions at our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. So, on behalf of Dan Hensley and Keith Perron, this is Paulette McQuarrie saying so long and see you soon.
You got love. You like it. You want to keep it. I don't blame you. Pray for it. Say hooray for it. But just stay with it. 'Cause there's nothing like love. Clown with it. If you drown with it, just go down with it. 'Cause brother, that's love. Boast of it. Make the most of it. Drink a toast to it. You can bet that for sure. You will never give it up. There's no cure, so live it up. Make hay with it. Night and day with it. Just move your heart right in and stay with love. Swing with it. Have a flame with it. A ring-a-ding-ding with it. 'Cause there's nothing like love. Shoot for it. Baby, root for it. Spin your loop for it. 'Cause brother, that's love. Roll with it. Set your goal for it. Give your soul for it. You can bet that for sure. When that feeling's nice and warm, you'll be living up a storm. Say yay to it. Don't say nay to it. If you're not made of tin, then give your heart a spin. Just move your heart right in. Stay with love. Oh, isn't love wonderful? When you got it, stay with it. Stay with love.